Hello, you. If this is your first ever time listening to the show, welcome.
Hello.
My mate Ben and I use funny chats about movies to help get ourselves through stuff. And if you're here for a wealth of behind-the-scenes facts and quotes from the filmmaker, well, we got you. We've got that today. It's all stuff you won't even find on IMDb. We are that good. But be aware, Ben has just had parts of his lungs taken out by a surgeon, and I'm having a crisis. And this movie in particular really hit a nerve with me about where we're at. So let's talk about everything that happened when we were caught stealing.
I like that. Yeah. I like that you clarified it was taken out by a surgeon, not in like a fighting homeless behind a KFC.
Bar fight, yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Vampires.
That's my check-in. Vampires.
Vampires, yeah.
They all go for the lungs, famously.
It's got the most oxygen.
That's a good point. I think that is a good point.
Yeah. That's why they do it.
I'm Ben Groves.
I'm Rob McFarlane. And welcome to the Every Movie Ever podcast! Now, before we start, quick big announcement, in fact, infamous paedophile king Ian Watkins, who sung in that band we all bought the first album of before they became the worst thing to happen to radio since television, has been murdered.
Hey! Woo-hoo-hoo! Bit of light news.
Bit of light news. Yesterday morning, inmates were let out of their cells, got into his, and now the world is down one paedophile, but has gained a new colander. Let's all rejoice and strain some pasta. But speaking of Ian Watkins and malicious paedophiles, Ben, you also had holes put in you last week. How was that? You're post-surgery. You've come out. You've had bit of your lung taken out by a surgeon.
Did. With my lungs stuck to the fucking inside wall of my chest cavity.
Glued.
Not glued. They sort of like just ruffled this, the flesh on the inside and then stuck the lung to the goop.
Great.
That's lovely.
That's okay.
It was all done by robots.
Well, what I've done is I've written an episode where you can tell us the story of your surgery whilst we relate it to Darren Aronofsky's Caught Stealing, starring Austin Butler, Zoe Kravitz, and Matt Smith.
All right,
because I think there's a lot of parallels between where you and I are at. We'll get into it through the show.
Yeah.
We'll break up the storytelling, like non-linear, like we're famously rat-faced foot fetishist Quentin Tarantino.
Rat-faced?
He's rat-faced.
He's
a rat-faced man.
He's an alright-looking fella. You'd give him a swift high-five.
I'd give him a high-five and no more.
Yeah.
That's all that hand is doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all it needs to do. Why would it need to do any more, Rob? Is that what you think about when you meet these famous people?
Yeah, I'm like, I wouldn't fuck you.
Absolute star fucker. My hand would only high-five you and that's all you're getting.
Yeah.
Like, they're all stood there being like, excuse me, cock, please.
If anyone had a thing for being hit on the cock, it would be Quentin Tarantino. But let's
probably
sum up the show a little bit. We're going to be getting into
how this film recreates what audiences have forgotten about the 90s.
The best new actor working in Hollywood.
Wow. Darren Aronofsky and the curse of the could have been.
Running away from the past while staring directly at it.
Finally. What's it all really mean?
What does it all really mean?
What's it really mean?
It means quite a lot to me this week. I'm in a bit of a blender. So, before I have an emotional breakdown, let's do a quick plot breakdown for the few people who have decided they're never going to see this film but still want to listen to the episode. So, I've written this week's. It's a very brief one because we're going to sort of go through some of the details a little bit later. But let me just start by telling you that Hank Thompson is a former high school baseball standout whose promising career was derailed by a severe injury and a tragic car accident. Now he lives in New York, he works in a bartender and maintains a kind of modest life with his girlfriend Yvonne. Until one evening, his punk rock neighbor Russ asks Hank to look after his cat Buddy while he leaves town.
Punk rock's a thing there. There was choices made. Hank learns that a key hidden in Buddy's letterbox unlocks a storage unit containing several million dollars, and nearly everyone involved believes Hank or Russ has access to it. As alliances shift and betrayals emerge, Hank finds himself at the center of a life and death negotiation he never asked for.
He tracks down the key after realizing he got shit-faced and threw it away. He confronts Russ, his neighbor, who leads him to the money, and in the ensuing chaos, Russ dies from head injuries sustained earlier. Hank then orchestrates a trap to escape the tangled web of crime and bent cops, culminating in him crashing his car, crawling from the wreckage, escaping to Mexico with the stolen funds, and like a good boy, sending a portion back to his mum back home.
Aw, what a good egg.
So I thought I'd pick this one this week. Because I watched it, I fell head over heels in love with it.
You did. You messaged me straight away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is a rare one. If you message me straight away about a movie, you do two things.
Right.
You do one of two things. You either say, this is fucking amazing, go and watch it immediately. I love this with all my heart.
Yeah.
Or you think that I want to watch it and go, watch it, I'm saying nothing. And I know that means that you think I'm going to love it. Otherwise, you stay silent about movies. You know, I'll ask you about it and you go, yeah.
I always fear giving. I'm really susceptible to going into a movie with an expectation.
Yeah.
And so my main priority is making sure I don't give those to people. You'll love 100%. This. Like, you can describe this film as a thriller, as a comedy, as a crime caper, as an examination of guilt, blame, and responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't recommend approaching it from any one of those angles.
Yeah, 100%.
It's a little bit like if somebody says, oh, you know, this film, it's hilarious, it's going to make you laugh. And then you go in, if it doesn't, you hate it.
Oh, if it's anything short of like side-splitting, I'm furious.
Right.
Not in the movie. The movie's let me down.
I'm
upset at the person that recommended it, yeah.
So I always try and keep shtum about movies. But this one, I was like, get it watched. We're going to do it on the show.
Mm.
I think it's shot incredibly well. I think the performances are incredible. We're going to get into all of the juice of why.
Mm.
But primarily, I saw a tall, athletic, blonde, mullet-wearing sober man get surgery and then realize stuff about his life. And I went, I know a blonde, athletic, tall, sober man who's just had surgery.
Oh,
I want to know what's going on with him.
The fact that you compared me to Austin Butler, A, I'm concerned for either your eyesight or your perception of reality, and B, I'm very flattered. I think it's
a relative difference thing. I see the distance between you and Austin Butler is about the same distance between you and I in my mind. So I just go, yeah, it's the same.
What the fuck? Okay. That's in no way, shape, or form true. But thank you. That's very flattering. But also...
or desperately sad.
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think it's more of the latter.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd put me and you in the same bullpen, and then I'd put Austin Butler on a fucking pedestal where he deserves to be.
A pedestal. Nice, yeah.
Because that guy is fucking gorgeous.
He is incredible.
Unbelievable. He is incredible.
We're going to get into his performance later. I want to know what you thought when you first saw this film.
I went in blind. It's one of those films that got recommended to me by people that I don't trust.
Yeah.
So I was desperate to watch. No. This is before you.
Yeah.
People that I... It's not people I don't trust. People whose choice in movies I don't trust.
They're different. They like
it's a subjective
things.
Thing. Yeah, like certain things. I don't like certain things. That's fine. But they tend to lean for stuff that I would rather...
If your mate who listens to nothing but country recommends a metal album, you know it's not going to be good.
But I would quite like to hear that.
I'd
be really...
You're curious, you're not confident.
I want to see your entry point into a new world. Anything like that, I'm desperate for. I fucking love that. It's when people say to me, like, I'll ask them like about films, I'll be sort of like, yeah, so you know Ghostbusters, and they're like, I've never seen it.
Mm.
But they say it in like an embarrassed way. I'm like, what the fuck? You should be screaming this from the rooftops, because... Not only do you get to watch Ghostbusters for the first time, I get to witness your reaction to you watching Ghostbusters for the first time. That's fucking insane. And I'm so jealous that you get to do this. But anyway, these people recommended this film to me, and I'm like, yeah, I'll get around to it. Don't worry about it. That kind of thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like a touch of salt. I watched it through and was like, fucking hell, this is a bit of all right. It's relatively fun. It's quite reminiscent of the 90s. It's good. And then out of nowhere, there is something that happens that left my jaw on the floor, and I was fucking A, furious, and B, hook, line, and sinkered in it.
Right.
In it for the fucking long haul. Do you know what I mean?
Which I'm guessing is the murder of his girlfriend, Yvonne.
Yeah, spoiler, Yvonne dies. She gets shot in the temple, but and it comes out of nowhere, and it's so fucking... At this point, I go in blind. I don't know the director. The only thing I know about it is it's an Austin Butler.
Austin Butler.
I'm on so many pain meds. I've taken 10 pills and I've had morphine, so this is going to get weird. Austin Butler, I'm like, it's an Austin Butler vehicle. That's all I know. And that's enough to sell me on it. I want it. I get so attached to Yvonne, lovely Yvonne, nice little safety net Yvonne, always there to help you out with a cup of coffee and a blanket. She's one of the fucking nurses from the ward that I was on.
Yeah.
Always there with a little snack box and a cup of tea when you need it. Safety net. So I trusted this film was going to be fine. Everything was going to work out all right. The fucking like shit it is. The second that she was gone, I was fuming. I was on the middle of the fence. I was I was a bee's dick away from being like,
I'm not enjoying this. Yeah.
Not that I'm not enjoying it. It's more that like, I could be enjoying this whilst also checking whether anything's going on Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's 6 out of 10. It's going to stay a 6
exactly.
out of 10.
I'm having a nice enough time. Yeah. It's good sort of like passive watch. This happens and I'm immediately fucking snapped into it. And I'm like, my safety net is gone. I don't know what's going to happen. I might free fall any second. Pause it real quick. Pull up IMDb, Darren Aronofsky. And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing to me? I didn't realize that this cunt was involved because I love and hate this guy. But for all the right reasons. He does everything right. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And I fucking love and despise him for it.
We'll talk about Darren Aronofsky later, but I want to...
But post-Yvonne dying, mate.
Yeah.
On the edge of my seat.
I think it starts out as a 6 out of 10, and it kind of, it just does, it follows the usual crime caper cliches.
Kind of, yeah. It does that, and then it gives you like a very sort of oversaturated, well-done... inciting incident that we've seen before in many, many, many other films that has been done differently, but it's ultimately the same outcome.
But what I love about the way that this differs is there's a few differences. Firstly, it doesn't fuck around with, he's in a bit of trouble.
No.
Immediately, the character that's been built up as his safety and his entire future is taken and is never coming back.
100%.
So he will never get back to where we see him start the film, which is not in great shape because he's... riddled with angst about this baseball career that he would have had.
Yeah.
And he's let the shame of that haunt him, essentially. Yeah. The fact that I had it all and I lost it. And she's the only thing that's kind of hopeful about his future. And she's taken away and now we're in there. And the other thing that it does differently that I adore is I think we've had a run of this kind of movie where these events happen to a guy, but he's a John Wicks... He's a Liam Neeson,
you're
going to get tooketh.
Yeah, 100%.
Austin Butler in this film
shits himself
and has all the talents of a bartender.
Yes.
And he ends the film with all the talents of a bartender.
Yeah.
He never fires a gun. He's never fired one in his past and he doesn't learn in this movie.
No, he doesn't pull jujitsu out of his arsehole.
Right. Like, it's not Jim Carter. We are looking at a normal person and it removes the kind of super heroics.
Oh, 100%.
That I think have kind of infiltrated other thrillers.
Yes. Yes. I get exactly. It doesn't necessarily mean superhero per se.
With special.
There's like a
magic,
weird.
We're not admitting he's got magic powers.
No.
But he's part of Mossad and he's been doing Krav Maga for 20 years.
100%.
For fun.
Yeah. His dad had a book on judo.
Yeah.
And he read it once. And now all of a sudden he's a fucking black belt.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean?
All of that is gone.
Yeah.
And I think it's a combination. It doesn't try and reinvent the wheel.
Does not.
But it perfects the wheel. And I've always said this about...
Oh, that's a nice way of putting it.
I've always said this about bands. Like, if you're going to do a blues rock band, great.
Yeah.
But we've got a lot of those.
100%.
So, like, don't be a 7 out of 10 blues rock band. Because we don't need another one.
Yeah.
Or when I hear a singer
right.
and they're very Adele, and I'm like, that's great, but we have Adele. So why... If you're going to do something that's been done before, you have to do it perfectly. And this is a rare example of one that does.
Chatpile is a band like that for me because Sonic Youth is one of my favorite bands of all time. But we have Sonic Youth at home.
Right.
We have a lot of Sonic Youth at home.
Albums
We have a whole arc of Sonic Youth at home, right? Anything that you could want from a fucking angsty grunge band through to sort of like covering the Carpenters.
Yeah.
It's in their discography.
Right.
You've got that. Chatpile come along and go, but...
What
if it's Sonic Youth with a little bit of spice and a little bit of a...
And for me, this is what this film is. It's a love letter to the 90s. It's a love letter to...
Crime noir.
And to put that spin on it and do everything really well. Like, talking about performances, I want to talk about the best actor working in Hollywood today. As far as
Pedro Pascal.
No, Pedro is overexposed.
I disagree.
I've had too much of him. He was great in The Last of Us. He was great in Game of Thrones.
We go back
Fantastic
a year.
Four can do one.
We go back a year and everyone wanted more Pedro. And then Pedro comes out being his true and utter self and does Pedro better than anyone has ever done Pedro. And people are a bit like, all right, that's a bit much now.
Too much of a good thing. I'm talking like Microbe in this movie, the Russian who keeps headbutting things, who crawls around on the floor like a spider.
Mm.
I love him.
He's good.
I'm not going to say he's the best actor working in Hollywood right now, although fun fact, he's actually a massive comedian in Russia.
Okay.
He's currently, he's not exiled, but he's had to flee since the war because he was the guy that would impersonate Putin on the Russian equivalent of SNL.
That's a fucking brave role to take on. That's a brave role to take on. Yeah, you can be on this comedy show. Listen, we've got an idea for it. Is this like Shane Gillis doing Trump right now?
Yeah.
It's funny how
Shane Gillis has stopped doing that recently.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah. He's too busy playing in Dubai. He actually didn't. He's one of the few that didn't. He put his foot down. No.
Yeah.
This actor, you might have seen him if you saw the remake from 2019 of Pet Sematary.
Oh, I did.
He plays church.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck, man.
We're talking about Buddy the Cat, played by Tonic.
Yeah.
He's a film set pro, according to Charlie Huston, the writer of the original novel and the screenplay.
That's mad.
How expressive is the cat in this movie?
The cat in this movie is fucking incredible, to be fair.
Right?
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of scenes where I'm like, that's got to be expensive CGI. And I did a double take and it's just the fucking cat.
Yeah.
Like, that was
right.
Insane.
Now, don't get me wrong. Everyone in this film is incredible. Austin Butler's performance.
Insanely good.
Immediately after Yvonne has died and he's just sat in the interrogation room, broken and bereft. You feel for him so much. He's suddenly a 19-year-old boy, not a 33-year-old man, which is canonically how old he is in this film. What were you doing when you were 33?
Was 1 year sober, so panicking. There was a few times, yeah. I don't really remember much, if I'm honest.
Mm-hmm.
Starting this, yeah.
Whereas I was still an active user.
Yeah.
Living in London.
Yeah.
In the music industry.
This is before.
Helping produce the show.
Yeah.
While you had a separate co-host.
Fuck.
Different times, indeed, but he's the age that we were then in this film. That's the character's age, according to interviews with Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah,
and it was another one of those lovely parallels.
That makes it more relatable.
I'm seeing a guy with surgery who's blonde and athletic and sober.
Okay.
I
was very recently sober as well. I would have been at 33 too.
It's 33 seems to be the magic number. Because I was 34, 35 when I went out the window. And my big mental breakdown and had to crash out of the music industry. Yeah, 34.
34. Because I remember it was National Cinema Day.
Yeah.
E.T.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah.
And there was something else, can't remember. But I remember those two.
So it's a film about a man in his mid-30s going through some shit and having to do some personal growth. And that's where I started to really, really connect with this one. And you've had your current courts dealing with the surgery. So I wanted to sort of talk about how were you doing before? Because it's been, your head was in tatters for 4 weeks.
It was longer than 4 weeks, man. It was a few months. As soon as I knew the date, it was in bits. It was about 2 months. But so I needed the surgery because my lung collapsed and never fully recovered.
Yeah.
It was just a reoccurring pneumothorax. No real reason for it. Stress was a massive factor. Treating my body like a bin for 2 decades was also a big factor. So my lung collapsed on March last year. I didn't get in touch with the doctor until November last year. I had bigger things to worry about. There was constantly something going on. But I got the date for the surgery and immediately started doing some research. And I could not find, for the life of me, a single good thing on the internet about people that have come through the other end.
Which
amazing.
Of course makes sense because you don't write about a thing that happened.
I understand it now that I'm out of it.
But at the time, you're just looking for some ray of light and you don't find it.
I was looking for one person that I could talk to who had had the surgery and I could just go, honestly, do I need it? Am I setting myself up for a rough fucking run after? And what does life look like after the surgery?
Yeah. Am I going to be long-term disabled? Like, am I going to be able to catch flights?
Because no one could tell me the recovery time. Some doctors were saying 2 weeks. Some doctors were saying 8 weeks. And it was, everyone was adamant on their answer. My sister's a nurse. She had input on certain things, but not other things. I just needed one person to speak to. And because I couldn't find that, I was panicking. So looking forward to the surgery, I could visualize in my head me sitting in a hospital bed. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what the room looked like or anything like this, but I could see the action of me sitting in the hospital bed. The thing that was terrifying is that I didn't know what life looked like after that.
Yeah.
So it was just black. I could not see a thing. I didn't know whether I'd be up and walking the same day. I didn't know whether it'd be 3 weeks before I'm back at work. I didn't know whether I'd be able to go back to work in the full capacity that I was before. Whatever, but will I ever be able to go to the gym again? Will I be able to run? What happens to walking the dog?
Yeah.
All these things that were just minor small questions that if someone could just sit there and go, yes, no, but that's me personally, you're going to be different.
Yeah.
It'd have been a whole fucking different ballgame.
The reason I ask, and believe it or not, it's relevant to the film. I think Charlie Huston, the writer, has done something really clever with the era.
Okay.
Because the 90s are, as painful as it is for me to say, they have moved into that era of being retro. Like, no matter what age you are, you in the 90s is an old version of you.
Yeah.
Even 50-year-olds looking back to the 90s, it was 30 years ago. So everyone is going, that's how things used to be. That's how I used to be.
Yeah, I guess we were in 1995 right now, people would be saying the same shit about 1965.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay, that's fucked.
So it's set in a time which puts all of us in mind of the way things used to be and the way things are. And it's
that.
A film about that crumbling and falling apart. Like, even the amount of footage of the Twin Towers that is in this movie.
Yeah.
They're constantly there. They're constantly there in the skyline. Something that used to be there and used to be true, but is no longer.
Yeah.
Yvonne, his girlfriend, used to be the future. Is no longer. His baseball career used to be true, is no longer. And they go through such painstaking effort as filmmakers to recreate this genre.
Yeah.
Like, they had to, to recreate this era.
Yeah.
They had to CGI, and this is insane to me, they had to CGI the graffiti back on to the buildings.
I can imagine.
Because New York is completely different now.
Gentrification and all this bullshit.
100%.
Yeah.
Which was starting in the mid-90s.
Of course.
And is fully completed now. They had to put barbed wire back on things because New York doesn't use barbed wire everywhere anymore.
No, I never even thought of that.
I didn't even think
that would be a thing, because obviously using barbed wire in the fucking biggest city, the most populous city on the planet, that makes sense.
Right. And the other thing that fucked me up with this is watching interviews with Austin Butler, and he had to watch episodes of Seinfeld to figure out how people behaved in the 90s, because he's a bit younger than us.
Not by much, though. I guess he was born early 90s, though, wasn't
born
he?
He's born mid-90s. So he was a child. He remembered very little of it. And simple things like when you get home nowadays, the first thing I do, and I'm sure the first thing you do, sit down, open my phone, have a bit of a scroll, have a bit of a text.
It depends on the day.
Right. But
sometimes it might be, if I'm having a rough day, it might be a bowl of cereal and a cartoon, just trying to take the edge off, because I can't drink anymore. So it's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Toxic Crusaders. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's it. Take the edge off a rough day. And then I'll get my phone out and start
going
for it.
Then you get your phone out, So that's just not a reality in the period of time. And so he was like, well, when I get home, what do I do? Simple things like the answering machine being a separate physical machine that you had to get tapes for.
Yeah, dude.
Was a different thing.
Yeah.
Even there's a shop, a video rental shop called Kim's Video.
Mm-hmm.
That's very briefly shown. He walked past it.
That's the one thing that I spotted and was like, that's gorgeous. That's gorgeous. I have a bit of that.
Because the filmmaker, Darren Aronofsky, lived in New York and he was like, I was in Kim's Video forever. Yeah. And he said one of his big measurements of success in his mind was he always wanted to be a section in Kim's Video.
That'd be sick. Oh, yeah.
He wanted to see his name and just have all of his movies.
That'd be fucking gorgeous.
And at a certain point, someone sent him the photo and he was like, that's it. I've done it. I've made it.
Amazing.
I'm the shit now. I'm the shit.
Yeah.
He had that glittering moment. But I find it fascinating that, like, there will be people listening who do not remember those 90s things. Like, you had to go to a place to get porn and the person who you got the porn from would know what porn you were into.
Yeah.
We were too young for that. We didn't get any of that because we were kids, but like...
Me and my nephew were too young to be renting porn, but we used to go to Blockbuster. If you're this guy, by the way, because if you're in Telford, you might not be in Telford now, but if you were in Telford about 2 decades ago, Yeah, about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe a little longer, 25 years ago. You were working in Blockbuster. You had two sleeves of bright colored tattoos. You had green hair and you used to chat about movies all fucking day long. If that was you, can you please reach out? Because you were my you were my childhood idol. Me and my nephew used to go to Blockbuster.
Right.
And we'd be like picking up DVDs and videos and stuff like this. We'd be talking about them, but they were way out of our age range.
Because
my brother and my sister would be like showing us films that we had no business watching.
Another thing that kids now won't understand. If a film is rated too high for you, you couldn't physically get a copy. No one would give it to you.
I had two exceptions on this rule.
Right.
There was one woman that worked at HMV that used to respect my confidence. Because there was one time where I bought Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Mm-hmm.
I walked straight up to the till. I put the DVD on the till and she was like, are you 18? And I was like, no. She's like, how old are you? I was like, 14. I can't remember how old I was exactly. Yeah. It was around then. I was like, 14. She was like, you know, this is an 18. I was like, I know, but it's Kevin Smith and I'm desperate to watch it. She was like, you know what? Fine. She served me the DVD. I took the DVD home. I watched the DVD. Fucking loving life. And then after that, every time that I wanted to watch something that was a little bit out of my range, I literally, straight on the counter.
Nice.
You're not 18. I'm not, but this is the new fucking...
You just nerded it out.
I could never but be the secret shopper.
She was at Blockbuster?
She was at HMV.
Right, okay.
She was at HMV. This is the guy, the green haired guy with the tattoos at Blockbuster.
Who needs to get in touch with you if he's still in Telford.
Please fucking reach out if you hear this. Me and my nephew would go in there and we would pick up DVDs and videos that were way out of our age range and he would notice us looking at these films and hear us talking about it and join in on the conversations.
Right.
So we'd be looking at stuff like, I don't know, like A Nightmare on Elm Street 3 or 4.
Right.
But we'd be discussing the last three movies going... XYZ, 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 and then he would pipe up and be sort of like, sorry, what? How are you guys watching all these films? Yeah. And it's like, well, you know, his mom and my brother, like, don't care. And we'd sit there and we'd talk about Sigourney Weaver and Alien and XYZ. So this guy would then be like, right, okay. And if we wanted to watch the sequel to a movie that we'd already seen, we knew that if we could have a conversation with this guy, and this guy knew exactly what we were doing, he was like these cheeky little bastards trying to like get in on my good side with a little film nerd stuff. If we got in on his good side and we're like, hey, do you remember the original? Do you remember how cool it was? Do you remember how you got to see it in the cinema because you're old enough and your hair's really cool? Do you want to maybe pop that DVD in this DVD case so we can rent it, please? He was like, I'm sure one of the DVDs that we've misplaced will turn up eventually. Let's say in 3 days. Fantastic. See you later.
So legend. If you live in the Telford area or Shropshire generally, and you know of a man with sleeve tattoos who had green hair in the early 2000s and worked at Blockbuster, email us at everymovieeveruk@gmail.com and we've got treats for you.
Seriously, you're my fucking idol and are one of the reasons that I'm this obsessed with cinema.
Yeah. Well, speaking of obsession, I think I'm gonna break format. Normally, we say what something really means at the end,
right?
But I think I've got enough that I want to talk about what this film really means that I'm gonna break it early because I think it's gonna take that long to get through.
Okay.
But I'm gonna break it early because I think there's enough meat on them bones that we can really get into it.
Get a chew on.
Darren Aronofsky, the director of this movie, for those of you who don't know, is like 2000s movie royalty. Because he directed a string of like pure critics catnip.
Mm-hmm.
Pi was his debut, which was like Kevin Smith, shot black and white for no money. Did really well on the festival circuit. And then his second movie was Requiem for a Dream, which Ben can never watch again because it got him into drugs.
I mean, it didn't get me into drugs.
Well, it didn't stop you doing drugs.
I was on drugs.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's the best film I can never watch again.
It's a formative movie. It's very emotionally powerful, very affecting, very savage movie about the darker roads that substance use can take you down. And what I find fascinating about it is you and I both watched it at formative age and then ignored every lesson in it.
I don't think that was the idea. Yeah. I mean, yeah, objectively, yeah. But it was more... The thing with Requiem for a Dream is it shows you the it's like the warning label on a box of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Smoking causes cancer. It's like, yeah, of course it does. But it still tastes delicious.
Mm, it
and makes me look super cool.
You know, when we were covering Alex Garland and he was saying there's no such thing as an anti-war movie because just by depicting the action,
it's somehow glorifying.
It's somehow glorifying it.
Yeah.
I do think Requiem for a Dream, in its own way, it did exactly that.
Oh, it glorified drugs to like a ridiculous degree. And I think it did it on accident.
Yeah.
So the only reason that I love Requiem for a Dream, and it's his one saving grace, is we get to watch Jared Leto slowly degrade. But he does it to himself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so it's
make those choices, wallow in that shitty pit. But and then in real life, he makes these fucking choices and then gets paid millions.
I think the difficulty with an anti-drug movie, and I don't think it's trying to be an anti-drug movie. I think it's trying to be a drama about drug users.
Yeah.
But I think the issue is that the worse treatment you give the characters as a result of them using drugs, the more you justify how good they must be in order to tolerate that.
Oh, 1,000%.
So what happens to Jennifer Connelly at the end of that movie,
yeah,
where she ends up dancing cheek to cheek.
Sure. You need to stop cracking that.
I love it. It's my favorite joke.
I know you do. It makes me feel weird every time, but it also gets a song stuck in my head at the same time.
Yeah, that's why I love it.
It's a double-ended joke.
Hey,
see what I'm saying?
There we go. There he is. But in order for her to get to that level of low, they must be great. Drugs must be great in order to make you do that.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting, complicated, but very, very, very good film. He also had movies like The Wrestler and Black Swan.
A Wrestler, fucking incredible.
I know you love The Wrestler, you hate Black Swan.
Black Swan's terrible. There's not a single swan in it.
There is.
There's not a swan in there.
In the ballet.
Nah, that's not a real swan.
It's not a real swan. There's no real
swan.
There you
go, there's not a fucking swan in it.
Were you hoping for like a swansploitation movie?
I wanted the black swan.
Like Shaft.
Like it fucking says on the tin. And what I got was fucking Mila Kunis fingering. Is it Mila Kunis?
Yeah. Fingering Natalie Portman. Shame.
There you go.
Oh no, what a crime.
Yeah, but it's like what? What am I watching? Where's the fucking swan? Is what I'm watching.
Okay.
It should be called Where's the Black Swan?
The issue is that Darren Aronofsky had these massive hits.
Huge.
And then he also has wildly divisive movies.
Yeah.
I know you're not fond of Mother. I love it.
Fucking hate it. Okay, Mother's a difficult one for me.
Because it's pure stress for 2 hours.
No, because I objectively, it is a fantastic example of what cinema can be.
Yeah.
The craft of filmmaking and the art of filmmaking in Mother is objectively fucking phenomenal.
Isn't it?
And I know that, and I understand that, but the film itself is everything that I hate in real life.
Yes.
But just played out to a 10th degree, and I don't like people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like renovating houses. I don't like house parties. I don't like fucking ignorant cunts that are just, it's so fucking infuriating on every level. And no matter what anyone says, at any moment in that film, I fucking want to pull my own teeth out.
I just want to pull
my own teeth out. Objectively, fucking phenomenal movie.
Yeah.
Subjectively, eat me out. Hate that shit.
You've also got The Fountain, which is Hugh Jackman in a bubble watering a tree with flashbacks of him being a Spanish conquistador and also flashbacks of him being a man in love with Rachel Weisz,
right,
who's got cancer.
So it seems like it's going to be one of those films that I'm going to have to be in the mood for, but also describe what mood I have to be in for that. Do you know what I mean?
It's a film that you get to the end and there's no plot. There's no narrative.
Sick.
You like David Lynch. He's very much the same.
Lynch is mint.
It's like Aronofsky trying to do Lynch.
But Lynch did Lynch.
Yeah, exactly. We come back to be yourself. And Aronofsky in that one isn't. He's doing Blues Rock at 7 out of 10.
Right.
He's not doing Chat Pile.
He's not Chat Pile. No.
And then Noah, starring Russell Crowe and Ray Winston.
Turn that off for about 10 minutes.
Oh, mate. If you'd continued watching, you would have been given a treat of one of the worst films ever made.
I'm going to watch it. I will watch it.
It is diabolically bad.
I tell you what we should do. Noah Napoleon.
Oh, God. I can't do Napoleon again.
2 seafaring movies.
Oh, God.
Let's strap on. I'll bring some Tribor extra strong mints so that we don't get seasick.
Napoleon was awful, and then Ridley Scott was like, oh yeah, but if you watch the director's cut with an extra hour of footage, I'm like, no, Ridley. Oh, yeah, you see, recently he said that all modern movies are awful. Yeah. He only watches his own films now because they're the only ones that are good.
I think it's rage bait. I don't think it's real.
Fine.
I think it's Ridley Scott's falling out of the sort of zeitgeist. And it's like, how do I call myself back in?
How do I make myself relevant?
I'm going to be an internet troll IRL.
Yeah, maybe it's that. Maybe he's listening to his kids who are like, what you need to do, Dad, is... Yeah. So my point being, Darren Aronofsky used to be the shit, but has been widely considered to have gone off the boil. Like, after Noah, he went dark for years. And nobody really expected anything from him. And then he came back with The Whale.
We did Mother after Noah.
Oh, we did Mother. Okay. Yeah.
And then we did Mother in 2017 and then went dark for 5 years before The Whale.
And then The Whale was kind of like, suddenly he was back with smaller stakes. And it's not my favorite film, The Whale. I think Brendan Fraser makes that film, not Darren Aronofsky.
That film destroyed me on so many levels, it's unreal.
But if you switch the main lead to any other actor, is the film memorable?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, not as memorable. You are correct in that. Anything Brandon touches, Brandon's this weird magical power where he's like Gary Oldman in some senses. Gary Oldman completely disappears into a character and you don't realize it's Gary Oldman, whereas
Brendan Fraser is always Brendan Fraser. But you don't care.
It doesn't matter what he plays. I wholeheartedly buy into it. Yeah. Doesn't matter what character it is. I know it's Brendan Fraser, but I'm so bought into the fact that it's him presenting anything.
I'd love to do his Man Out of Time trilogy because he did Encino Man, George of the Jungle, and Blast from the Past.
George of the Jungle is so fucking good. That film still holds up. Still holds up. That's my... When I was sick in primary school, Ghostbusters, George of the Jungle... Star Wars.
But with that passage of time and things getting forgotten,
right,
I feel like Darren Aronofsky kind of, with this film, is admitting that that's where he's gotten to. That sense of, you used to be the shit, you used to have a massive baseball career, and now people are like, oh, he's off the boil. Same with Matt Smith, who used to be Doctor Who, and no one has given a single fuck about what he's done since.
Bro, The Whale, in a way, is kind of like his Ivan. So for five years, he had a little safety net of, I will make my comeback with Brendan Fraser's comeback, and it will be the absolute tits. And I don't think it panned out to be what he wanted it to be. And it did kind of die on its ass a little bit. It
completely did.
That is fucking insane. Right. So then with zero safety net.
Right.
He accepts everything, says goodbye to the old baseball career, and just makes a film that I did not realise was Darren Aronofsky until Yvonne died.
Then
I had to rage check IMDb to see who I was furious at.
I feel like the reason I love this film is there are a lot of parallels at the moment, because in this movie, Austin Butler's character is constantly going on about his baseball career that was in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The film is set in a period of time that for everybody now seems like an age ago.
It was 3 decades ago.
3 decades ago.
Outrageous.
We were children. Darren Aronofsky was a different man. But importantly, Darren Aronofsky was at the height of his powers. It's set at the exact same year that they shot Requiem for a Dream.
Ooh.
And Austin Butler's character is the exact age in the movie that we were when it all went wrong for us. And so for me, how many times on this show do I mention, oh, when I was in music, before I put myself through a window, how many times do we talk about the people we were and how we had it all, it was right in front of us, and now everything we have is difficult? Which is a direct quote from Austin Butler's character in this movie. That sense of, we've lost what we had. And we're now having to deal with the rubble. We've got this big thing going. I mean, you just had, I mean, how, like, you had people in your chest.
Robots.
Robots in your chest. What was that like?
I mean, so after shitting myself for months and making it a much bigger thing in my head than it needed to be, you know this, I was talking to you about it constantly because I was literally shitting myself. Like, could not.
You couldn't do anything.
I couldn't get the wobble out. Yeah. Like, I was just constantly wobbling. Every time I went to a shop, it was the alcohol aisle was looking great.
Yeah.
Because all I was thinking was, if I could buy a pack of smokes and a bottle of whiskey, I would not give two shits about any of this. The time would pass completely. Might be my last chance was a weird thing because I couldn't see what life was like after the surgery. I started getting weird about it and was thinking,
maybe I can have a drink this week because maybe it's my last opportunity. Maybe this to ever is
the last one. And I started doing this whole weird thing of like doing stuff that I wanted to do for a little while, but under the wrong premise. So it was always like, might be my last time, might be my last chance. Took my dog up a mountain, might be the last chance. Went to Bella Italia, might be my last chance. That wasn't something that I wanted to do. I just saw Bella Italia and was like, you know what? This might be my last chance to get a gelato and a shit spaghetti. I got discounted Bella Italia. Still got robbed. Absolute shit.
But then you got to hospital.
Got to hospital. Everyone there was fucking lovely. Ward 223 at Stoke Hospital. Fucking love you. I don't know if anyone will ever hear this. Everyone that worked there was warm, mm-hmm. kind, understanding, patient, and most importantly, completely understood that you are going to be shitting yourself for whatever you've got going on because it's you're in that ward. Do you know what I mean? You don't get to that ward without something having to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And something having to be done in the heart or lung region is normally a big fucking thing. Yeah. So they understand that you are going to be shitting yourselves. And every single person there was like the nicest person that exists. I made incredible friends with the woman that changes the bin bags.
Yeah.
Just for no reason. Just
you still got an event?
Oh, dude, the vent was odd, man. When I was getting the anesthetic put in my hand, the guy didn't turn the machine on, but he didn't realize at the time. So he put the mask on me and mm-hmm. was like quite dramatic and sort of held it in place and held my head in place and was like, this is going to smell weird, but it's just mm-hmm. the plastic. You are about to get lightheaded. Let me know when it's happening. Whilst he's doing this, he's got his fucking hand over my face. I can just see like it looked like a normal ceiling tile
mm-hmm.
with the, when a child draws the sun in crayon.
Right. And they or do a spider's web.
Yeah. They do like the little lines coming yeah. from the sun. It was the lines from the sun. Without the sun in the middle, it was just the lines in like the same pattern.
So an impossible object.
An impossible thing to look at. And I'm trying to figure out what it is. And it looks like each individual line is like a slot in a fan that right, can be okay. opened and closed.
Okay.
I have no clue what this is.
Right.
But I'm staring intently at it and I'm like, this mystery is going to keep me going.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, this you're going to be getting lightheaded right now. Can you just let me know when you're mm-hmm. getting lightheaded? And about 3 seconds go by. But it feels like a year
yep.
of me trying to figure out this mystery. He's like, are you there yet? Are you lightheaded? And I'm like, no.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, okay, all right. Well, it's going to happen in a second. Just let me know. And I keep staring at this fucking mysterious fan ceiling tile. I've never seen anything like it before yeah, or since.
Yeah.
And until I told you and Josh about it when yeah. you both came to visit me. Thank you both. It was very lovely. I didn't even realize. I didn't know whether it was real or not because it might have just been a whole fucking thing. Anyway, he realizes that he hasn't turned the machine on, leans over, but because he's got a fucking mask on my face, there's a huge chunk of plastic now dragging my eyeball down into my cheek. And he asks the other guy that's in there who's like helping with the surgery, and they're both having a laugh and a giggle. Mm-hmm. It's all very lighthearted. You just turn the machine on for us. And as soon as he hits that button, he goes, right now, you should start to feel. And I just went, oh, because the fan sort of, you know, at the end of Evil Dead 2 when the portal appears
yeah,
and it just goes,
Matrix warped, yeah.
It just fucking warps. I traveled to a different dimension and I woke up to a Scouse woman screaming and I had no clue what had happened,
mm-hmm.
but I woke up and they were like, are you awake? And I was like, And they're like, are you in pain? And I was like, no, you need to check your chest drain. So I tried to move out of the way, like roll onto my right side a bit, and they fucking rolled me onto my chest drain. I yelped like a kicked puppy, and they were like, yep, that seems fine. And then the warmest feeling washed over me from fingertip to brain to toe, and I was like, oh, hello. How have we been?
Hello, narcotics. Hello. I've missed you.
This is a weird one. What a mighty fine opioid rush that has just hit my eyeballs. I can tell you the second. I can't tell you the second because it's all just, it mushes into one. I remember the Scouse woman screaming because apparently someone sat on her hand, but it was the hand with the
cannula. Yeah.
So she was screaming about that. I woke up, I literally lifted my head up. And there was a woman opposite me, about the same age as me,
mm-hmm.
blonde hair down to her shoulders, one knee cocked up on the bed, literally put her head up almost the same time, looked and just went, put her hand up, one hand up, I put my one hand up. And then we both hysterically burst out laughing. The Scouse woman is screaming. And for no reason whatsoever, I'm starting to check in on the Scouse woman. I'm chatting to the nurse who's asking me questions. And it's just sort of like, how are you feeling? I'm just sort of like, Fluffy. Fluffy with a side of warm. How you doing there, love? You okay there, darling? You okay there? Hey, listen, so have you ever seen Aladdin? Yeah. What movies you like?
Yeah.
Films of Quentin Tarantino?
So it wasn't the demon that you'd built it up to be.
It was the nicest experience I've had in a long time. And the amount of weight that it shed when it comes to health anxiety, mm-hmm. being scared of hospitals, being scared of going to the doctors in case of needing to go to a hospital, refusing to take painkillers in case I one day need to take over-the-counter painkillers to avoid going to the doctors, which will avoid me going to the hospital, mm-hmm. which is an insane way to live your life. All of that weight was lifted from my shoulders and fucking just cascaded off. But can I tell you the most important thing that happened to me?
Right.
Months of looking, not being able to see past the operation.
Yeah.
It was nothing but black. The day that I had my operation, I woke up. They took me back up to the ward. 10 minutes later, there was two people stood in my curtained off thing. And they mm-hmm. were like, we're going to get you dressed and we're going to take you for a walk. And I'm like, sirs, I'm not sure if you understand this. I have just woken up from surgery. It's been pretty mental. And they were like, yep, we're going for a walk. So I walked like Mr. Burns up and down this ward for about 20 minutes. Fucking fantastic. The most important moment that's happened to me in the last few years was when I got back from the walk and I was sitting mm-hmm. in my little hospital chair. I had my chest drain next to me. It was like a little portable machine thing. It was disgusting. I called it the juice box, made it much better. I had a cup of coffee in front of me. The light was coming in through the ward window. The curtains on the bed in front of me. His name was Matt. Matt, if you ever hear this, you're an absolute fucking diamond. I hope you're okay. His curtains were drawn and they were just the right shade of purple. It was the shade of purple that I needed to see after seeing nothing but black for mm-hmm. months. And I beaming ear to ear. It was the most life-affirming moment I've ever had where I'm beautiful. Like, it doesn't matter how scared I was,
yep.
how blind I was, how just fucking paralyzed with fear I was. That purple was always there. It always will be there. And it was sitting in the sunlight at just mm-hmm. the right moment for me to go, that's what I wanted. In the one person yeah. that I was searching for to talk to, I just wanted that bit of purple. Gorgeous moment.
Beautiful.
I was fucking beaming ear to ear,
man. That was your Austin Butler on the beach after the fucking 48 incredible. Hours of
That's
hell.
That's exactly what it is.
Right.
Exactly what it is. Fully on the beach, appreciating everything a little bit more.
What's the baseball use? Because at the end of this movie, everything he goes through, and I think the thing that I find interesting about this film now is I feel like we're moving in different directions. We're almost opposite in that you were dreading the future.
Yeah.
And didn't know what that looked like afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still in that kind of like I had my baseball.
Right.
And one of the things that I find really poignant about this film is he loses his baseball career when he crashes a car and he fucks his knee up mm-hmm. so much that he can't play anymore. And his friend dies.
Yeah.
And he is always going on about my baseball career. When Yvonne gets shot, mm-hmm. he shoulders all of the responsibility. He's not the one that pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
It's these two madcap Jewish gangsters who are chasing him throughout the whole film. They kill her as retribution for him running away from them. So he's running away and bad things happen because he ran away.
Mm.
In the same way that when his initial car crash happened, he crawls away.
Yeah.
And he speaks to his mum in Act 3 and he's like, no, this isn't an accident. Because he's talking about everything that's going on, Yvonne being dead. He's like, no, it's not an accident, Mum. This is my fault. Just like my friend dying was my fault. And for the first time, he accepts responsibility for the thing that's actually the bad thing about that crash. It's not his knee getting fucked up. It's someone died.
Yeah.
And he accepts responsibility. And he says, I killed him. Yeah. My actions led to him dying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he's never done that before, because he's never taken responsibility
mm-hmm.
for the fact that he crashed that fucking car
yeah.
and people died and other people besides him were hurt.
Yeah.
He's then tried to balance those scales by taking responsibility for everything since.
100%.
Yvonne's death, yeah, that's on me.
Yeah.
Didn't pull the trigger, but it's on me. Everything that happens, he blames himself for, yeah. as if somehow that's going to equate to the blame that he should be putting on himself for his friend's death when he was a kid. And it's only when all of this stuff happens, and it's only after he's admitted that he was the one driving, that, like, life is bad, but it's because he made it bad. It's only when that happens that he then finds out that the Jewish gangsters are the ones that killed Yvonne. And rather than saying, I'll take the money because it was my fault she died, they're telling him,
yeah,
it was your own fault that she died.
Yeah.
For the first time ever, he goes, actually, no.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I'm not going to take responsibility and the money. Mm-hmm. It would have been far better for him. He could have just taken that cash
mm-hmm.
and gone, yo, you're right, it was my fault. And that's what he's been doing all the way through the film.
Mm-hmm.
But because he's owned up to his past, he gains self-respect.
Yeah,
and to definitely. Say, fuck you, no, that was on you.
100%.
And I feel like I'm at that point now where I've been internalizing everything
mm-hmm.
and looking at the past and looking at the past and going, oh, well, you know, this, that, and the other. And I feel like I'm finally getting to a point now where I just don't, I'm not making everything my fault anymore. I'm going, no, actually, that is on you. That is on you. That is on you. Whilst also maybe learning to turn off my baseball and not keep going, oh, when I was in music, I used to be a sound engineer. I used to be a music producer.
Mm-hmm.
Just going, I'm a videographer now.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a dog food company in Telford.
Mm.
That's my beach. That's the beach I'm trying to get to. Okay. And I like the fact that this film is all about an inciting incident. It's about a time before and a time after.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've very much been looking at the time before.
1,000%.
And I think you were very much looking at the time coming up. So it's like we're on the same road, going different directions, and this film's in the middle.
I think that's a really nice way of putting it. It's a really good way of putting it. So I don't think I have one baseball. I think baseball for myself is me getting myself into situations and getting myself into a predicament that is actively negatively impacted me.
Mm-hmm.
And then being a victim of the incident, not the entire prep where I could have avoided it at any step. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I saw myself becoming a drug addict. I saw myself becoming an alcoholic. I could have stepped off that road.
Mm-hmm.
I could have paid more attention to what was going on. I could have eased up on the stress. Mm-hmm. I could have not been working 7 days a week. I could have paid attention to the fact that me pushing myself as hard as I did in my career because it gave me a self-worth, ruined relationships, mm-hmm. friendships, family connections. I missed important events. I missed out on tons of stuff. I can look at bands that I've been in.
Yeah.
Where we have record deals on the table and for whatever reason they aren't signed. And I can point fingers in every direction and go, well, that was on you. You know, I'm a mm-hmm. fucking playing drums for nearly 3 decades.
Yeah.
The opportunity was there 3 times. 3 separate bands, 3 separate record opportunities, 3 separate labels were willing to sign a band that I was a part of. And it just, for whatever reason, didn't go through. And I can sit and do all this and I can play victim to it and I can be sort of like, oh, woe is me. Woe is me. Or I can go, fucked it.
Mm-hmm.
Wildly fucked it.
Yeah.
And that's completely fine. It's fine that I fucked it. And it's fine that I went as far as I did with these mistakes because I can sit and I can admit they are mistakes. And to turn baseball off is to go, I did fuck up. And this is the lesson that I'm taking from it. And then that TV is turned off.
But this is the interesting thing, is I think both you and I, mm-hmm. with this show,
mm-hmm.
are on the beach. And sometimes the podcast is the television mm-hmm. with baseball on it.
100%.
And I feel like I spend a lot of these hours picking at scabs.
Yeah.
Rather than just going, turning around and looking at the beach.
100%. I don't think the scabs
of what used to be.
Yeah.
And why I got there, and oh, I'm, you know, wisdom and all this kind of thing, when really, mm-hmm. I need to go out and start making new mistakes.
Yeah, 100%. And you're going to make a ton more mistakes,
yeah.
And you're going to have a ton more things that you think are your baseball. What I'm trying to work through at the moment is, I feel like I've been living through the death of ego for a little while, mm-hmm. and I'm getting used to it, and I'm getting used to not sort of falling back into old habits and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And I'm being more self-aware with things. Feel better for it, which is good. But I think part of the death of the ego is realizing that the beach isn't a single thing or a single person or a single situation. It's the shade of purple
totally.
That I woke up to. It's the fact that I would consider me sitting on this couch with you discussing this movie is the beach for right now.
Totally, that's what I mean.
And when I go home and I play Battlefield 6 and get shit on by 12-year-olds that have got the reflexes of a fucking ninja cat
whilst I'm struggling
on my pain meds and my horror morph to see in a straight line. Do you know what I mean? That's going to be my beach then, because it's the fun. It's finding a situation that you can truly be yourself in and not have to give a fucking worry about anything from the past.
I think my issue is that I've been using so much of my mistakes in the past to constantly be serving, constantly be trying to fill other people's cups.
100%.
And I need to just go, I am at a point where I'm like, I'll fucking crash the car. Yeah. I'll just crash the car because I've had that phone call. I've accepted that.
Mm.
And rather than just picking at it still, going, I accept it again.
Yeah.
And I accept it again.
Yeah.
Just go live my life.
Bro, it's a good place to be, man. It's a weird place to be, and it's scary as fuck because there's no safety net. There's no Yvonne.
There's no Yvonne, and I'm. It's going to take me a while to shake the feeling of it being rude to say no to things or 100%. Say that's too far. Or
I'm still working on that. I've been working on that for about 10 years, and it's still weird. I hate it.
But just like, this is mine, and like, fuck all he is.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Is a part of it.
Yeah.
I'm
proud of you, man. I am really fucking proud of you because this is like, go back 6 months and this is different Rob.
100%.
Not better, not worse, not
different. Yeah,
anything else, just fucking Rob. But you're more Rob than you were, and it's a weird thing to say. It's a weird thing to say because it sounds like the hippy-dippy bullshit. It sounds like the sort of person that would like, I get that spirituality is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I get that that is a thing. But I also can see that a certain type of person would be more drawn to spirituality because it takes away totally. Any blame.
It's that.
Everything happens for a reason. Therefore, I'm the victim of my own timeline. Right. And it's like, I don't get how much more. You can't. There is only so far that you can remove yourself from a situation and still play the victim.
Right.
Other than going, well, it's not my fault because the universe did it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it was God's plan.
Right. Yeah, and I get this. Yeah. There must be a weird comfort in it, and I get that, and that's fine. And if you want to...
But like, it's not a sincere place to hold faith from. There are sincere places to hold faith, and that's not one of them. Yeah, I get it.
I'm not saying that spirituality is that exclusively.
No. I'm just saying a bad example of a faith-having person is the person who uses it to absolve themselves.
I've met tons of examples of great faith-having people recently. I told you about the
pastor that you
the
met.
The pastor that I'm talking to at the moment. He's fucking incredible. Like, I do literally hours on end chat to that guy. He's fucking lovely and so sincere about everything.
Mint.
I'm lucky enough to work with him as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
just get caught up in these fucking conversations whilst like, sipping a Starbucks is mint. Mint.
But yeah, this is why I thought the film was pertinent.
You picked a mint one. This is like the shit.
The other thing I love about it is despite everything we've spoken about, we've not mentioned the fact that the performance, well, we did briefly mention the performances are brilliant, but every other aspect is the comedy, the cinematography of this is beautiful.
It is.
The pacing's mint.
Oh, dude, don't. I'm working on pacing at the moment. I feel like IRL, I'm working on pacing at the moment as well. So I'm really paying attention to everything. If I listen to a new band, I'm like, that's a fucking, okay. Mm-hmm. That drop is where it needs to be.
Yeah.
I find like a lot of new metal bands at the moment are just, it starts with a breakdown.
Yeah.
And then goes into the weakest.
That's the new hardcore. The
weakest riff you've ever heard.
Hardcore
and it's like,
has become all breakdowns.
All breakdown. It's essentially they're writing songs that can be reacted to on TikTok in 30 seconds. And then the rest of it is absolute shite.
Yeah. It's, 100%.
It's a fucking pandemic
this film,
that we're in, man.
None of that. It's
this film,
it's
mate,
rocket ship all the way through.
I think I mentioned it earlier. I was on the fence about whether I was being curious about what's going on Instagram, and then just at that right moment,
it take off,
fucking absolutely locked in,
and then all the way to the end, just continues straight through. So it's a perfectly made film, and what I love about it is it feels to me like Darren Aronofsky has accepted Noah, has accepted The Fountain. And like you said, as I've accepted that the whale might have been his Yvonne, and just gone, all right, I'm going to make a mid-budget crime film.
Yeah.
It's not going to try and do too much. It's not going to be 15 ideas crammed into a bag.
Yeah.
It's going to be one thing, done brilliantly.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a perfect example of something people have seen before, because not everything needs to be a fucking reinvention of the wheel.
100%.
And as a result, it's the least Darren Aronofsky movie in probably ever.
Yeah.
It's and 1,000% among his is. Best.
Yeah, dude. It feels like Darren Aronofsky has had a conversation with someone who has fun making films.
Yeah.
It's like he sat down with Tarantino.
Yeah.
And he went, the whale was a thing. Fucking was a thing, mate. Incredibly executed piece of cinema. I'm about to go and have some more fun with my 10th project. Just call it my last one. Just to go out on a bang, have some like proper fun with it. I was going to be the critic. Wasn't really feeling it. I'm going to take my time with it. I'm going to have some fun. Yeah, that's all well and good, but what do you mean have some fun? You mean have fun after making the film?
He's not a very fun filmmaker.
After making the most serious fucking films that I've ever seen in my entire life that genuinely upset me or thrill me on a level that very, very few other people do.
It's probably, I can't remember a film of his that's had this much comedy in before.
This feels like he was behind the camera with a smile on his face during every scene, and that makes me enjoy it more.
Way more. Way, way more.
Yeah, 100%. We're talking about this like he's never had fun making a film. He's probably fucking loved every second of it. But this one translates through the lens.
The last scene with Jennifer Connelly must have been not too bad a shoot.
No, that would have been fucking awkward as anything. You're taking the piss. Can you imagine directing that? I mean, like on a serious level, I've worked your way up. This is your second ever feature. You've got to a point where you're like, right, now this is the scene. There's a room full of criminals.
She'd have had a body double, sure.
Sure. But also, you're still directing that human person on the end of a double-ended dildo.
You'd have had fun with it. You'd have just made it into a joke. You'd have been like, all
right. Would have. The 15, 16, 17 other people in the room.
Yeah.
I'm saying that's an awkward shoot, man. That's a fucking awkward day at work. You going home to your wife after that, are you?
Do you know what it is?
How was work, honey?
It's a bold day at work for an extra. Because the main cast, they've had a whole arc, right? Mm. Even the guy playing the drug dealer, he's playing the villain.
Yeah.
So you can say, yeah, I'm on camera.
That's justified.
Cheering that act.
Yeah.
Because of an artistic end that I'm an integral part of.
Yeah.
The extras. You seen that footage of you cheering?
Oh yeah, that's
cheering the worst thing on. Yeah, it's 50 quid.
Yeah. Hey, mom, how's it going? Oh, how's it going, sweetie? You okay? How's California? Oh, it's great. I've just been cast in a film. Fantastic. When's it out? I can't wait to go and see it. Well, it's about Jared Leto slowly destroying himself with heroin. He's also a cunt to his mom, who is destroying herself through dieting pills. Mm-hmm. She goes clinically insane. And then his missus ends up on a double-ended dildo, and I'm in the room clapping cheering as Jennifer Connelly takes one for the team.
I'm in it for three frames, but it lasts forever.
Maybe skip Thanksgiving this year.
Yeah.
Eh? I don't want to tell your nan to go and watch that at the cinema.
Yeah. I put my face that you made 50% of on film forever, cheering that.
You know how much money
and
it costs
what?
You
it
to raise
it could have been
me.
Anyone, but I made sure it was me for 50 quid.
There you go. How much money did you spend raising me as a human person for me to then go and do this as a job?
Well, look.
That's a rough day.
What are you rating Darren Aronofsky's Caught Stealing, starring Austin Butler, Zoe Kravitz, and Matt Smith?
I'm going to give this a 7. This is a
solid 7.
It's right up there. I had more fun with it than I thought it was going to. I went in with quite low expectations. On one hand.
Yeah.
But you messaged me about this movie, and you have two responses. You either say this is mint, go and watch it immediately, or you say, let me know what you think when you watched it. Otherwise, you don't talk to me about it because I feel you have a saying. If you're going to spend 2 hours of your precious time on someone's film, it better be worth the 2 hours. Because if it's not, you're just going to move on with your life and think, I'm never getting those 2 hours back. And that translates because you will never talk to me about a film that you've watched where you're thinking, I'm not getting them hours back. You don't even talk to me about
it.
I'm not going to mention anymore.
Because
I'm not going to waste any more time on it talking about it.
I don't want to slag a film off for someone to then go into it and go, oh, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Because it's just expectation setting is the worst one. So 7.
7.
I'm going to go 9.
Okay.
I'm going to go 9. It's a mid-budget 90s crime noir that had no reason and no business giving me what it gave me.
Yeah.
It, this could have been just a normal little film.
Mm-hmm.
This could have been, I'm trying to think of it, like a, this could have been a Ryan Reynolds movie.
How so?
In terms of, you know, Free Guy.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Free Guy.
The one where he's an NPC in a video game.
Yes.
It's fine.
Is it?
You move on. It could have been one of those. It could have been one of those. Turn up. Get your 2 hours. Leave going. Stuff happened.
I don't know. Because that's it. So, you know that IF, Imaginary Friends, whatever the fuck it is.
No.
It's another one of those movies. Detective Pikachu, another one of those movies.
Right, exactly.
That kind of...
The one where he meets his younger self. He goes back in time. Yeah. Just like boilerplate.
What's that, Story of Adam or some shit?
Story of Adam, yeah. Boilerplate. It could have been a
same character in
everyone. Could have been a boilerplate crime mystery.
Yeah, okay.
Here's some money. There's a bit of a runaround.
Yeah.
It all gets resolved. And it is that.
Yeah,
but fair. It's a perfect example of that with some subtext that hit me right in the gut. So it's nice. A 9. It's a 9, and it's a beautiful return to form for a director whose work I've sorely loved.
I can appreciate that.
But that's it. That's the end of the show.
That is the end of the show, guys. Thank you so fucking much for hanging out with us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Welcome. Well done for being alive.
Thank you.
I've cancelled the order for t-shirts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with the whole idea.
It's all right.
Just before we do go, or just before we do anything else, do you mind if I give a couple shout-outs real
quick? Please do.
Few shout outs. Everyone on Discord, thank you so fucking much. You guys were lovely. It was great coming around from surgery. I had a little message from Rob saying jump on Discord when you can. You were all being super supportive, well wishes, all that stuff. It was fucking gorgeous to wake up to. Thank you so much. Massive shout out to obviously Stoke Hospital, Ward 223. I don't know if anyone will ever hear this, but thank you for everything. Matt from Bed 4.
Legend.
Hope you're doing all right. Absolute fucking legend. Josh, you, Bailey, Ad, Alex, Lars, Amber, thank you all for coming to see me. My brother Stu, who reached out after years and came up to see me. I fucking love all of you. Mitch and Maddie, love all of you. Really do. It made the difference. And I wouldn't have gone through with any of it without any of you. So, yeah, thanks for that. Thank you very much.
Mate, literally our pleasure.
It was amazing.
We love you.
I love you too. We've got time for Comic Corner.
Next week.
Save it for next week.
Save it for next week.
All right.
I've got screenshots we can use.
All right.
We'll have a proper Comic Corner next week.
Sounds.
Because we are over time and out of time.
No worries.
I go out of my head when you're not around. We're out of touch. We're out of time.
What's that?
That's Eric Prydz. We're out of touch. You're out of time. So to thank you for spending an hour of your week with us, especially at the start of the week, Ben is going to wrap up the thoughts, themes, and feelings of Caught Stealing.
Ben's into in a fucking warm morphine blanket right now, so I need to...
So he's going to wrap it up in a way that motivates you through the week, because we know a lot of you listen on a Monday. So this is Ben's Caught Stealing Monday motivational pep talk. And in the meantime, I'm just going to tell you to...
Listen, Austin Butler had his baseball thing. That was his big thing that got away from him. It was the one thing that he was like, you know, big mistake. He was playing, he made himself into the victim too. And it doesn't matter whether like Rob using like the old career or me with like a fucking heap of shit, or whether it's something bigger or smaller or anything like this. It doesn't really fucking matter. The one thing that you need to remember more than anything is that morphine is a hell of a painkiller.